the agency by shelter. A special welcome to our queen penguin, Nicole Yates.
To do that, yes. Thank you.
Perhaps one should be talking about penguins and reproducibility. They have this funny way of hatching the eggs. So just leave you to start your talk and we will listen with close attention.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you. Right, so my name is Nicole Jans. I'm an assistant professor in international relations with quantitative methods. It's my official title. At the University of Nottingham, and before that I taught at Cambridge Statistics for Social Scientists under the Department of Sociology. And I hold a PhD from the Department of Politics here as well. My research is about globalization and human rights. So the big question that I do is what factors contribute to better or worse human rights protection in the world? And I do a little bit of corruption research, corruption in Brazil. Another thing that I do is I'm a promoter of reproducibility. I'm an ambassador at the Open Science Framework, OSF, and there are some other initiatives that I'm involved with. And a teaching perspective is what I will focus on, because I teach and I try to integrate transparency, research integrity into all my statistics courses. And at Cambridge I taught a replication workshop for a few years, and that workshop students had 8 weeks to pick a paper in their field, try to reproduce the findings, add some knowledge to it, maybe improve it, and then try and get all published. I've been doing this for a while now. Okay, solving the reproducibility crisis, a teaching perspective. This report is about the reproducibility project Cancer Research. Most scientists can't replicate studies by their peers. So this was a large initiative where 5 landmark cancer studies were taken by a group of researchers, a large team, and they tried to reproduce the findings. And in 2 out of the 5 studies, they managed to replicate it. And in 3 of them, they just couldn't get to the same results. They tried the same experiments, tried to run the same analysis, and it just didn't work. So that was very worrying. That goes across disciplines. For example, in psychology, there was a similar initiative trying to replicate findings of 100 studies from the top journals. And more than half couldn't be reproduced, so they couldn't get exactly the same tables or figures, and couldn't get the same result.
Are we talking here about repeating the activity of the experiment or reusing the data?
Repeating the experiments.
Yeah, okay.
And so some of the problems, well, the main problem was they also tried to, so they did 2 steps. One was using the same data and running the analysis, but they also tried to rerun the experiments to see if they can find the same effects. Most of the time they found that they could maybe find effects that looked a bit similar, but in the original study those were significant, and in the replication study they often didn't reach significance, which tells us a little bit about publication bias and what you can get published and what you may not be able to get published. Okay, so many studies are not reproducible. We don't actually know how big the percentage is. And one of the problems is behind that is that authors often don't share their data. Does anyone know the Reinhart-Rogoff scandal? Have you heard of it? Probably not. So this is a scandal that kicked off the reproducibility discussion in economics. These were 2 researchers. They wrote a very influential paper in economics, and the paper found that government debt hinders growth. So this paper and the findings were used by policymakers to justify austerity measures. And a student tried to replicate this study just as a class assignment, just to learn statistics. He couldn't find the data anywhere online, so he wrote to them several times, and after a while he got an Excel spreadsheet with all the data, and he tried to use their original data and rerun the same analysis as it's written out in the paper, and he couldn't get the result. And it took a while for them to figure out that actually there was an error in the Excel spreadsheet. So one of the rows had just moved down one bit.
Yeah, happens.
Copy pasting, right? And this had distorted the whole correlation. So some people say don't work with Excel spreadsheets.
Right.
use R instead or whatever software you use. So this was a big scandal. Of course not. But that is a different story. So when you're a politician and you have to cut the budget, you are looking for studies that will help you justify that. And there might be another study out there helping you with that. Yes, but you can see that there's a big impact on, you know, when you have these errors in research. Now, in political science, which is my own field, there was recently a case 2015, that was the political science big scandal. Actually, a PhD student at UCLA, published a really nice article in Science, which is really great. We don't usually do that in our field. He published a study where he showed that when in the US, when you send campaigners door to door and have them talk about gay marriage and gay rights, they can persuade people, normal people, to change their mind about anti-discrimination policy. So he had some survey data and some kind of narrative data that he used for this study. And another student at Berkeley tried to replicate this study, and he wrote to the original author's name is Michael LaCour, and he wrote to Michael LaCour and said, hey, you have this fantastic study in Science, I want to replicate it and learn from what you've done, this is just for my statistics course, can you share your data with me? And he didn't hear back, and he tried a few times more, and Michael LaCour said, actually the data have sensitive information, because he talked to actual human subjects. So again, the replicator, the student who wanted to see the data, said, okay, well, maybe you can anonymize your data set, or just tell me exactly how you did it and which areas. So just tell me more, give me more information. And then LaCour deleted the whole data set and said, actually, just to protect the data for security and privacy reasons, no one can ever see this data again. Now the university, University of California started investigating, and they found out that he had made up all of the data. They were just fabricated. There was no actual real study and real data behind it. They also found out that he lied about some grants that he got on his CV, so that he was dodgy in more than one way. But this was really embarrassing. And this was embarrassing for the university. The study was, of course, retracted, and it was also embarrassing for his supervisor, Diese's PhD supervisor, who had been a co-author of the paper, but he had just trusted that his student would do good work, and he never had actually seen, where this data and how this data was collected. So this triggered a whole big debate in political science about data sharing. Now, one of the problems underlying this is that still there are a lot of journals who don't properly enforce data upload. I have a study from Political Science from, actually it's a few years back now, 2013. This study looked at the 120 most important journals in the field and try to see what kind of replication policy they have. What kind of materials do the authors have to upload? And at the time they found, among 120 journals, there were only 18 with a replication policy. All the others just left it to the authors. Now, a little bit later, in 2017, Niels Petter Gleditsch and I tried to see if anything has changed. And so now there are more and more journals, not just in my own field, but in different fields, that have good replication policies. But we went to the journals in our field that made a change and looked into their archives to see if they don't just have a new policy, but also if authors are actually doing it. And so in most of the cases you can find at the beginning of an article you can see a URL telling you this is where you can find all the materials. But we actually found that our authors say that, but then when you click on the link there isn't anything there. Or maybe there's just a variable code book, but not actually the data and your, I don't know, R code or something. So there still remains a problem that this isn't actually enforced, even if you have a replication policy. So, sadly, one could conclude that most scientific knowledge that we trust remains unchecked, because you can't actually check it. Okay, solutions. Yeah. Of course, the first thing to look to is journals, right? Many journals now have started to at least adopt a policy, which is a good thing, because it's a good start. So the transparency and openness promotion guidelines, TOP guidelines, that have been recently put up, these are guidelines that journals can take and adapt them to their particular journal style, let's say. So, for example, there are different levels of intensity. Level zero, it's probably hard to see from there. Level zero, level three. So this is a very strict journal. This is not such a strict journal. And they have different dimensions. For example, data transparency. A journal that says, okay, our replication policy is not so strict, would say, we encourage data sharing, but we don't enforce it. But a journal that is what wants to be really very strict would say the data have to be posted to a trusted repository and independently reproduced before they get published. So maybe the journal editor has a student or a research assistant who will run the R code to see if at least you can get to the same tables, right? If there are no errors in the code, for example. Other dimensions are methods transparency. Often that means sharing your code or pre-registration, right? Some journals, BMJ or other journals, might ask for pre-registration of studies, which is fantastic. Or replication. Some journals, so for example, a journal that is not very strict on a very low level of reproducibility would discourage replications. So if you write a replication study in this journal, you just couldn't publish it. And better journals, in my opinion, encourage you to submit a replication study and you'll be treated properly and be sent out for peer review. So this is something that exists out there. And more journals, actually now, you can go on their webpage, sign up to the TOP guidelines and promise to adopt one of these levels in some of these dimensions. And it's just a tool to help journals to improve reproducibility from their end. Similarly important, obviously, are funders, right? These are just two examples. The National Science Foundation says that if you want to include, if you want to submit a proposal, you have to include a data management plan. This is part of your proposal, of your grant. And you have to describe the data that you're using, how anyone can access these data, and in which way. And you have to say where exactly you will upload your data so that other people can use it as well. Or the Research Councils UK actually state publicly funded research is a public good. So everyone I should be able to discover the data, and the authors have to make it possible that you can effectively reuse them. Now, this is fantastic, but I'm not so sure if they actually go after each grant and look who is actually really doing it on all the grant web pages and, you know. I would be surprised if everyone did what they promised. But it's a good start. And then, if journals are not fully enforcing it, and funders have difficulties looking at what the authors are doing, then we need to look at the authors, so that basically that's us. And I think a good way is to promote the benefits of working reproducibly. Of course, reproducibility is great for science, it's the gold standard of scientific research and all that, but I think actually, you know, it's very time consuming to prepare your data for upload, and you have to put in a lot of resources for that, so maybe we should think about how is it good for myself and my career and my CV to work reproducibly. And there's a great paper by Florian Markowitz from Cancer Research UK, who lists these reasons with some background from his own lab. And here they are. And this is something that applies to natural scientists and social scientists the same, I would say. So for example, when you work transparently, you can avoid disaster. So one thing that I have done is one of the first papers out of my PhD, I asked another student, if he could please just run through my code. I was really paranoid, because when you promote reproducibility, you better, you know, work reproducibly. And I asked him, can you just rerun my code on your own computer, just to see if you get all the tables? And I had 30 pages of supplement. And so he found that two tables couldn't be reproduced, because somewhere the function in the R package was outdated, and the table just pulled the previous results with a similar object name, and I had two tables that looked the same, and the third one missed a column, and it was not extremely bad, but really not very good. And so before I submitted all my things to the Harvard Dataverse, which is the repository that I use, I made changes, and then he did it again, and then it was fine, and then I uploaded it. And I'm really glad I asked him to do that, because I would have been quite embarrassed when I stand here saying I promote this, and then making mistakes myself.
There are you've reminded me of another little hidden danger, that the result that you can get when you're doing analysis using software, because you're working usually to finite precision for binary arithmetic, the results will depend on how many binary places you worked in. So you can get very different answers from, you know, the difference between, say, 20 and 40 binary places. It may not look like a big difference, but in certain circumstances that can make huge changes in the results that you get.
For sure. Especially if you're on the verge of reaching a significance cutoff point or not, and then you don't display the exact information behind your little star that you put. And often, I mean, the problem that I had that was, in my case, that one of the R packages had been updated, there was a different kind of optimizing algorithm behind it, and it just had slightly changed the way, you know, it calculated, and suddenly.
Well, one area where it can make a big difference is when you're doing simulations. You can get it's a kind of catastrophe theory effect. If you know what I mean by that.
Explain.
Where a very small difference in the number that you start with can produce a huge difference further down the line.
The butterfly.
Yeah.
See, and this is something that cannot always be avoided, right? I would be surprised if someone who re-ran the analysis with a newer package or something, or re-ran the simulation, gets to the exact, I don't know, tenth decimal. I think that is okay, but I think you need to give all the information of exactly what it is you did with all the different versions of your package and all the information. And if then there is something not, perfect, at least you have been very transparent. And you, but you haven't tried to hide anything, and you haven't done, say, sloppy errors, right? So other advantages are that it's easier to write papers. If you comment your code well and you have all your data ready, you can reuse your code later for another paper. It's just easier to pull up your results and create your figures, you know, after, say, 2 or 3 years of research, or a PhD, in my case, 4 years. When you have work transparently, you'll make your own life easier as well. Sometimes reviewers might ask you to, have a quick look at the data behind a nice figure. This has happened to Florian, who wrote the paper, and it was very easy for him to appease the reviewers because he said, here's the link to the data, have a play around yourself, and they immediately said, yes, fine. Continuity of your work, your own work, but also in the lab, so if the postdoc leaves and the next one takes over, if you get a vastly massive, thousands and thousands of lines of uncommented R code, it's just awful. And you might always almost just start from scratch again. And the same when I'm still sometimes thinking maybe I should publish another chapter from my PhD, which is a while back now. I haven't really done it yet because I feel like, oh, the RScript version 1, 2, 3, 54, like, it's kind of daunting to go back to your old work and kind of make sense of what you've done. So you're leaving something behind for yourself as well. And then, of course, reputation. If you're known as someone who works transparently, even if you do an error or if you do something wrong, as long as you have worked transparently, I feel, you can, I don't want to say you can get away with it, but at least you haven't tried to hide anything. So one of the people I know and work with is Ted Miguel from Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. He's an economist, and he's a reproducibility promoter, but he has everything, usually he has everything online. Someone tried to replicate a study. It was about, I think, a particular form of worms in people, in Kenya, I think it was a health study, and someone wanted to replicate it, and he handed over huge boxes of field notes, all the data, everything, and it turned out there was a small error somewhere, but since he had been so upfront with everything, there wasn't really a scandal to the scale like I've shown you earlier, because he just basically, he laid everything open. Right. Now, I think what we all and what basically everyone should look to is future researchers, right? So it's nice that we are all motivated to work transparently, but I think it would make everyone's life so much easier if you kind of start, grad school, or you start your degree, and the first day in your methods class you learn this is how we do things, we have a reproducible workflow, we work transparently, right? So here are some ideas that that someone can do when they do teaching. I'll use an example, a course that I taught here at Cambridge, and I've said that before, where students try to replicate a published paper. And through that replication, they learned different things. They learned how to work reproducibly themselves, because you can immediately see when something is reproducible and some when it's not. but they also learned how to write a good paper, or when you see a paper that looks very polished and then you go behind that, they learned which are all the steps that are behind it. Right, so I think it took me some persuasion because I needed to kind of help students understand why they should be doing this instead of going to a textbook. So I think it's a great way to learn statistics because you work with real life data from a published study when you replicate. You follow all the author's decisions. Often you can use this measure or that measure or this test or that test. And when you replicate, you can really follow exactly why they did this or that. Luckily, these replication studies have to handle a lot of bugs and difficulties and challenges. And that makes it more fun than textbooks. I remember when I came started my own stats training, I was almost shocked by the difference of how I learned all my panel data analysis and regressions from my textbook courses, and then I went to my own data and had all these missing data and lots of things didn't compute, and I just couldn't bring the two together, and I always thought I'm doing everything wrong. I don't know how to do it, I can't do it. Until I figured out that textbook and real life data, there's something in between. You need to kind of learn what is practical, how to solve things, and this is something you can learn in a class like this. Yeah, you can learn how to establish a reproducibility routine. I'll say a bit more about that later. And a few of my studies have actually added value to their replication project and published it as the first paper in their career. And that's obviously fantastic. So how to replicate a study? There are a few challenges. These are just the four main challenges. The first one is that there are a lot of different definitions of replication. What's a replication? What's reproducibility? Now, depending on which field you're in, you will learn something very different. So in some fields, you talk about reanalysis or reproduction or conceptual replication, and in some fields, you talk about direct or internal replication. It's actually very simple, but it doesn't make it easier for people from different fields to talk to each other. Now, generally, I say everyone should use the terminology in their own field, but make very clear in their paper or in their teaching what is behind that. But from political science, something that I work with the students, is I distinguish between duplication and replication. I know that in other fields, people might see it slightly differently. But a duplication would be, the goal would be to verify the research results by using the exactly same data set with the exact same methods. So running exactly the same models, and ideally in the same software. So this is almost like fact-checking, right? And this is already a good exercise for a beginner in statistics. Now, a full replication would actually test the robustness of the original study. So here you would collect new data, maybe you run your own experiment, and you would run new models. Maybe you think that a certain type of model is much better than the other one. And this is obviously a much better contribution to science, a full replication study. And this is something that you can get published. A mere duplication might lead to, I don't know, a scandal or something like that, but it wouldn't really be something you can publish, because you need to add value. Now, if you're a psychologist, the exact same story would have just different labels, right? So in psychology, you would call the duplication a closed replication. Again, you would verify the results by using all the same data. And the full replication is often called conceptual replication, where you have the same paper or the same theory, but you try and find new evidence and new tests. So often this distinction is pretty much, it's the same, but across fields there's a different label attached to it. Now, Michael Clements wrote a paper about what does it mean when a replication fails. And in that paper, he has this huge table. I don't mean for you to be able to kind of, it's too long, too big, but it has all the different fields, economics, statistics, political science, sociology, psychology. And he says, these are all the names for duplication, and these are all the names for the robustness checks. And they have all slightly different names, and here are the papers that tell you, Ioannidis and other famous papers telling you where these come from. So it's annoying that there are all these different labels, but I think if you're aware of what your field does and how they talk about a certain thing, then you can use that. So the second challenge is, how do you pick a good study to replicate? So the answer is really, it depends. But a really good replication project should be a study that is really relevant and that has a lot of impact. Sometimes that would be a paper where the results are widely accepted, but they haven't really been checked yet. Everyone kind of keeps finding the same thing. Sometimes, for example, in my field, human rights, it's very hard to measure the protection of human rights because you have to somehow quantify maybe reports of Amnesty International or something like that. And once in a while, there's someone who comes up with a new measure, and that is fantastic, but that also means that maybe all the other studies have to be rechecked using that new measure, or democracy measures, things like that. So that calls for a replication of previous work. Or you read a study, and you think, there's one factor that they have completely forgotten. There's omitted variable bias here. We need to replicate that study and add in this new variable. So it depends on what field you are in, what is your interest, and kind of where the field is, how the field is moving around. So as I said earlier, this scandal about the Reinhard Wagoth paper, I mean, it's easy now to say that this was the perfect replication project, but it was a high-impact journal, the American Economic Review. It had impact on society, because the paper was used by policymakers, and so this is a fantastic study to pick. There are some other people who use replication in the classroom as well. For example, Matthew Salganik, a sociologist at Princeton, and he tells. I've been talking to him and we've been exchanging ideas, and he says the biggest problem is that many students pick papers where the stats are actually too difficult. They haven't learned how to do a particular thing yet. So I always try to tell my students, and they have really different levels. Select a study with methods that you know or methods that you can learn quickly. Maybe you have a buddy or a supervisor who can help you with that. Don't pick studies that are too old, because the field may have moved on so much that you don't actually need to replicate a study from 20 years ago anymore.
Comment on that one. Granted that the field may have moved on and therefore an old study may no longer be relevant, but there are certainly many cases where an old study, say from 20 years ago, has laid down a direction of research. Which may have been mistaken.
Yeah.
And people have been working on that for 20 years because they believe study number one.
Yeah. One of my students said exactly that, and he came to my class, I think it was development economics, and he picked a 20-year-old study.
Uh-huh.
Something about wheat and some other crop and how... I forgot what exactly was being calculated, but that study was seminal in the field and had kind of informed a whole new theory. And so he tried to replicate that study, and he ended up publishing a working paper, not so much a kind of mathematical replication of the stats, but he kind of ended up revisiting the theory. He also said that the evidence is not very good, and with new methods you can dispute what the claims are, but he wrote a new theoretical paper. So you're absolutely right, there are exceptions. Ideally for students it would be good if the data and code are available, because it's an easy starting point, but we know that it's not always possible. But I had a few students who dropped out of my class because the data weren't online and the authors just didn't want to send anything. And then it's very hard for a student to start within a class project. It's just not doable. Okay, how to replicate systematically? So this really depends, right? If you do experiments, that's a whole different story. But I think it follows along similar lines, right? So I think it's always important to have a kind of project plan. You need to know what you're doing. This is almost like a pre-registration kind of plan that you can make for yourself. You need to know what the main results are that you want to reproduce, obviously. You need a list of all the models that you need. You need a summary of the data availability and where they are. And often students said, yes, yes, the data are online. And when I said, open your computer and show me, they weren't actually online. So it's really so banal, but it's kind of important. And then it's always good, once you've read the paper and you've had a bit of a look around, have an idea of how you could extend the paper with new data and new methods. How could you do a really a full replication, not just a duplication? This sounds very easy, but sometimes when you read a paper, it has so many tests in it. It can almost be overwhelming. So there are different ways of dealing with that. Some just did screenshots of every tiny little table, and they tried to kind of go through each of them step by step. But the steps in general are selecting a paper, accessing the data and code, identifying each variable. Have you ever come across a paper and you think, oh, fantastic, and then you look at the variables and they have these cryptic names,
yeah,
and you can never find out which those... Yeah, this takes a long time. So this can take 2 to 3 weeks. Then you would go through, you know, reproducing the tables and figures exactly the way the author did it, and compare your results with the original results. Depending on how good you are at stats and how well you know the paper, this can take up to a month or longer. So this is a duplication up to here. And most of my students have reached that stage in the replication workshop. And then the interesting part comes after that. So actually, I would say 60% of my students did this part afterwards in their own lab, with their supervisors, in their own time. But you want to do something like add value, collect new data, new variables, new model specifications, maybe make a new theoretical contribution, and then compare again with the original study. The typical things would then be get feedback from your peers, and you know, do a journal submission. These things we all know. But once you've done that, you have done a full replication. Actually, sometime around here in my class, for those who are a bit more advanced, I ask the students to exchange their class projects and let the other person replicate, at least duplicate, I should say now. Duplicate what the other student had done. So they are kind of becoming each other's replicators for cross-check. And this has been the most horrifying experience for them, but also the most revealing, because they thought, oh, I'm being really meticulous, I've done all this work, and I've been super transparent. And they give it to the other student, and suddenly the other student says, I don't understand what you're doing with this, what's this function there? So, this was something that having students cross-check their work was actually the best thing of the course. How can you add value to a replication? Or to a duplication now? I should revise my slides and be really more precise here. You can always make a theoretical contribution, of course, right? And say the whole argument of the paper is not very good. But statistically, and again, this really depends on your field, I've collected. These are all the different things my students have done over the years. Sample size is often a problem, particularly in political science where you deal with countries. There are only so many countries and so many years that you have data for. You would be surprised, in political science there aren't that many studies that do power calculations, especially in human rights, because there's so much missing data. So this is so easy, such a tiny thing, but this is something where you can make already kind of a contribution. Obviously, you often want to try to collect more data, more years, more countries, new samples, new experiments. What I sometimes do is I look at maybe only OECD countries versus, African countries, because the effects can change, where you can look at before the Cold War and after the Cold War, and often correlations might change. Important also missing data. In my field, we've only just started using multiple imputation for missing data, and I've taught a workshop on that. For years and years and years, what we do in political science, we just list-wise delete. Whenever there's an observation missing, it's gone. The whole case is kicked out. And that biases our results. So that's a big problem. You can do other things as well, like changing the measurement of your variable. You can log something or not log something. So that this is something that's kind of something you can do. It sounds like it's not a lot, but it can actually change your result. Model specification, of course. You know, just better models accounting for certain things that the original author hasn't done. And then extra sensitivity checks, you know, especially when it comes to significance, can you do some extra checks on robustness here? Looking at outliers and things like that. So, you might have a completely different list here when you do that with your students, but this is something that I've collected.
There is a feature which I think is perhaps implicit in some of the points you've made, which is that, as it were, what sort of measure of general value do you use? And the contrast which I use as an example is the contrast between mean and median.
Mm-hmm.
They both tend to be called average.
Mm-hmm.
In general publicity, but they can be very different in behavior. And the example I use is, say, if we take people in this room, and if we look at their annual salaries, that will have a mean value, it will have a median value. Then in comes Bill Gates. The mean value goes through the ceiling.
Yep.
The median might not change at all, or at any rate not by very much. Conversely, look at the definition of poverty. Mm-hmm. In this country, you are defined as being in poverty if your income is less than, I think it is 60% of the median income of the country. Well, you can eliminate poverty quite easily. You take everybody who is between 60% and the median, 60% of the median and the median, move them all down until they're just above 60%. You now have a lot of money which you can give to the people who are below the 60%, and you can probably bring all of them up above 60%. So you have eliminated poverty.
There we go.
And you may even have some money left over which you can give to the people above the median. So
yeah.
There are different ways of representing the changes that can take place, and in some respects things are sensitive and in other respects not sensitive. And in your choice of what you use as a representative statistic, you can, I won't call it bias because it's not bias, but you can in a certain way misrepresent.
Yeah.
The truth that someone else might be interested in.
Did anyone read The Guardian today?
No.
There was a double page on wage gap, income gap in British companies. And they had a really nice figure explaining exactly how the median and the mean are influenced by extreme values.
Yes.
And how the mean gets pulled over and the median isn't. And I was really happy. I think I'm going to take a photo on my phone and keep it for my class. Because that's one of the first things in the basic statistics courses that we teach. But actually you can do it really nicely with simulation. There are some online tools that show how the mean jumps around. Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah.
So your choice of what statistic you use influences the result that you present.
Yeah. Right, so let's get to a fun bit, comparing your results with the original study. So obviously you have to be extremely precise when you say what you could replicate and what you couldn't. And the reason is that obviously you don't want to say a replication has failed and create a whole scandal if there was only a teeny tiny thing that is not really that important, right? And you want to use appropriate tone. So a replication can fail at different stages, as you know, all the different steps I said and how long they take. If the results can't even be duplicated, that would probably show sloppy science, hopefully. Actually, I don't think that there are many researchers out there making up data. I think this doesn't really happen a lot, right?
Which field you're in?
Oh, okay.
I've been involved on the legal end, as it were, with several.
In
more common
cancer research?
And medical stuff, yeah.
Okay, I take back what I said.
The most famous case of all of these is known as the POTTI case, P-O-T-T-I. It's the one that brought down half of Duke Medical School. It was found by statisticians, it was brilliantly done. But there are many, many of those.
Yeah. The thing is actually, we don't actually know how many that are out there.
Yeah.
Because not many people are doing replications. I'm promoting replications, but essentially, you know, especially if you're at the start of your career, you need to produce original research. Yes, okay, so when you do new models and new data and new measurements and different tests, you need to say exactly what you've changed and which way. Otherwise, it's difficult for a reader to judge if the replication really failed, or if it's really just a slightly different problem that you're looking at, or it's a completely different analysis you're running. For example, there was a paper in Human Rights that showed how globalization is good for human rights, and another paper used a different measure of globalization and a different measure of human rights, and they said, oh, globalization is bad for human rights. And so, that was interesting, but also it showed, yes, when you use different measurements and you have different, slightly different concepts, then I'm not really surprised that the result is different. And this is something you have to describe really very early. So this is a checklist that I give to my students, just questions you can ask yourself of things, why did the results change. This is just a good list, really. But what I want to get at is how to communicate failed replications. I tell my students to be professional, because especially when you're a student, you don't want to be vulnerable to, say, a seminal figure in the field that you have replicated. And so, you know. Right. I've looked at papers that were replication studies, and then I've looked at what the original authors said. So replicators, someone who has replicated another study, let's look at these. And they wrote something like, we find that coding errors, selective exclusion of available data, and unconventional weighting of summary statistics led to serious errors. Or replicators would write something like, if we cannot even reproduce the original results using the same publicly available data, there is no need for further commentary. So they're still trying to be fairly neutral. Now, original authors often respond in a more drastic way. So these are the original authors who have answered to a replicator or replication. In the same journal, they would write a comment. The replication was less realistic, inconsistent with the substantive literature, and of limited utility. Or they would say, oh, the replication is fundamentally flawed. Or they would say, there were statistical, computational, and reporting errors that invalidate the conclusion of the replication. So I have much more examples of this on my blog, and I collect them, and I call them replication chains, and they talk back to each other. And it is very entertaining, but also, you know, it shows that it's, if someone came to replicate my study, I would be happy that actually someone is reading my study, but I would also be quite anxious about it, so I can understand why people talk like that. Okay, publishing a replication study. Ultimately, everyone has to get published, and so this depends on everyone's different field. Good replication studies get published. I would usually tell my students to write a solid paper, not just some kind of quick research report. You know, what's the possible relevance, the group hypothesis, just as if you're writing an original paper. In some fields, and in politics, this is still often the case, I would say, don't sell it as a replication. Now, probably in cancer research, or in psychology, and maybe a little bit in economics as well now, it's really appreciated that people do replication studies, especially if they replicate big landmark studies. But in politics, unfortunately, we are not that far ahead yet. So I looked at a few replication studies that did get published, and they write things like, our estimation approach builds off of the methodology and paper used by so-and-so paper. This is the original study. Adding measures of electoral closeness, and so on. So there's in the whole paper, there was no, replication didn't appear, that word. Or this is another replication study. We analyze a diet year data set used by this author, and we find these improvements. So reanalyze is a word that they use. And you can see the headlines are always about the topic itself. There's nothing that says replication here as well, or here. I revisit an earlier study. So basically, in political science, I tell my students, follow this because you want to get published. Ideally, you wouldn't have to play that game, right? Because a good replication study is something that is worth it, I would say.
How would you say if you publish it, honestly? I just do replication. How would you say it?
Well, you could say, basically, you would say replication of, and then the original study.
Yeah, but you're trying not to piss off the other authors and the reviewers, right? It's a delicate political game being played.
Yeah.
I find this very immediate important questions as a very good actually reflect of the matter. It's not war of game,
okay.
It's not something, but I think it's good they reflect in the thing. In some sense, as you said, you think this study that was important.
That's true.
That
so,
forced it.
Okay, so what I like about your comment is that if we really think about what we're doing, we are not out there to hunt down people, but we are out there to look at a question. And that's actually a very good point that you're making. I haven't actually looked at it this way. I've always looked at the selling point. But you're right, we are not out there to catch an author, but to look at a question.
So
that's actually very nice, positive view.
People found probably the sincere.
Probably too. But then again, you know, you could just very easily say, I replicated this study to look at this larger question. You know. But I can see what you're saying, and I really like that point. Yeah. So maybe all these people were very sincere and didn't try to sell their study, but maybe this is actually what they meant. So these two, I know, these are students. So of Gary King, a famous political scientist, I know that he advised, okay, I don't know, but I think he may have advised them to write it like that. Or maybe if you submit to a journal, maybe the reviewers would say, you know, rephrase it to make it more interesting to a wider audience.
In your field, is it common to send these sort of papers to the same journal with the original article?
Yes, because you have a higher chance of it being sent out for review.
I suspect it's the opposite in medical world.
You think?
Yeah, but I'll say you're just fiddling with the numbers and you haven't done much.
So the journals wouldn't want to discredit what they have published before?
You bet. It's Nature and Science that particularly
Okay.
As you know.
Interesting. Okay.
guess for me the other question is, where is the distinction between replication versus trying to establish where the truth might be by synthesizing all the relationships? So that's the whole concept of pattern answers.
Yeah,
but
that's a different game.
Yeah.
What's the where the truth might be, what sources of entry the data might be.
But aren't you assuming that the results that you're using for meta-analysis were in some sense right, or at least not total garbage?
Exactly, that's a very good comment, right? So when you look at fields that are a bit further ahead in the whole reproducibility kind of discussion, they have moved on to doing meta-analyses for these purposes. Well, you know, this could be a first step. If there's a landmark study and you think something's not right there, you would want to replicate that study. But if there are, say, 15 studies on a certain topic, maybe it would then make more sense to revisit them by doing a meta-analysis. In political science, I haven't seen that many meta-analyses because it's sometimes very difficult to extract all the tests. And, you know, in some fields you do mostly a t-test, maybe, but sometimes here you do really very kind of complicated regressions with like a robust standard error here and a slightly different robust standard error there, then it's difficult to kind of extract all those and run the meta-analysis. So I haven't seen that many meta-analyses in political science, but I know in other fields they are much more common, and I think they are a good way to go about it. So I'm teaching at a summer school in Amsterdam in April. And one of the sessions there is how to do meta-analysis, because there are a lot of psychologists going to that summer school. Oh, here's another study that actually just said a replication. This is an economist. So sometimes they do write replication.
Can we just flip back to that?
This one?
This one is actually describing what they call a replication. What I would be interested in is knowing what they mean here by replication.
Mm-hmm. Don't remember exactly what they did.
It's because they say this study replicates the empirical findings.
Yeah.
And does this mean that they go back to the original empirical results? Or does it mean that they rerun the experiment?
I'd have to look at the study again. Yeah, you're right, that's a good question. So, they say they use an extensive data set of international disasters. I would think that the first thing that you usually do is you use the same data set.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that they actually had maybe a better data set. It sounds like they're selling an extensive new data set in their study. But I'd have to read it again. I hope they didn't. But I mean, you know, they may have just updated because there are more and more disasters. And the original study was in 2007. This was 2014. So maybe, you know, I don't know which disasters were in between that. But
there's also some vagueness in the interpretation of the word empirical here. Because if you are looking at a data set of international disasters,
mm-hmm.
assuming that the disasters have been correctly recorded, would you really describe that as empirical?
Big question.
Yeah. Observational, certainly.
Yeah.
Because something happened and you made a note of the details of what happened. Empirical implies, to me at least, implies some kind of intervention.
Okay. In political science we often say theoretical versus empirical. One works with data, often observations. The other one doesn't. But I don't know about how they do it here.
This is quite an important area in this, to, as it were, try to say precisely what you mean by certain words, and not assume that everybody else will make the same understanding as you intend.
So if I had been clever, I would have actually copied the whole abstract here, which would have given us more clues. Okay, so I'll make a mental note for my slides next time. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. There are more and more journals that are open to publishing replication studies. Now, this is obviously because I'm a social scientist, right? So there are some political science journals. This one actually openly invites replications. It's a new journal. This is the top journal in America with the science review. Psychology and economics. This slide I usually use when I talk to students so that they know where to turn to. But as I said earlier, I usually say go to the original journal, and if they are not interested, then go to one of these journals. There is a new journal, ReScience, and it uses GitHub. This is really new. I don't know that much about it yet, but they invite replications. I saw some, when you go to the webpage, which is right here, ReScience.github.io, you can see a few studies that have already been published in the natural, it's a natural science kind of journal. And so this is actually a journal reserved for reproducing previous work, which I find very interesting. And just today, I have talked with someone. We are thinking of developing a social science replication journal similar to this, something where we would have I don't know, pick a few landmark studies that from different, maybe sociology, psychology, or maybe social psychology and political science, write a big grant, find teams to reproduce these studies, or replicate those studies, and invite open replications as well, and then try and get some the debate a bit further in our own field. And this is my motivational sheet. Usually, again, this is directed at students. These are all papers by early career researchers from my own class, except this one. This is from Gary King's class, who have published their replication studies. And some have just put up a working paper on their lab's webpage, but I think this is still good when you're starting out. And some have gotten into good journals with their work. Now, this is nearly my last slide. Now, if this is something that you find interesting, this can be applied in different ways. Obviously, in your own work, you can try and work with reducibly. But I think universities in general, and I mean Cambridge, I know, has done that. In Nottingham, I'm planning to do more things like that. You can have workshops and teach how to use, you know, R Markdown, R Knitter, how to use GitHub and all these things, and I know different fields are doing it to different degrees. I think what actually my best tip would be, use replications as class assignments, maybe not a whole paper, but just one table. Instead of the textbook problem set, just one table of a paper where you can get the data beforehand from the author and let the students work with this. It's so much more interesting for the students. Or actually a real replication workshop like the one I've done. Now, I've tried to think a little bit how PIs and labs, we don't have that in our field, but you can establish a culture of reproducibility and replication within your lab, and it's kind of really up to you how you would do that. But one thing is to ask lab members to replicate each other before you submit to a journal, just to make sure you can reproduce your figures, for example. Well, I mean, so in fact, I have a feeling that this is something that, oh, the day before submission, everyone gets really stressed and says, shouldn't we have replicated it? Let's quickly try it, and then it may not work. I think this is...
Considering that sometimes analysis is the genetics,
takes thousands and thousands of lines of code, and it's
thousands of hours.
Right, so I mean, I've done some simulations and some multiple imputations that took 2 weeks on my computer, and I have to admit that I would be very hesitant to kind of, although, you know, to, if you know how long it takes, and then this is kind of, this helps you to judge how long it would take to reproduce it. I can see that not in every case you can... Yeah, and then you can maybe only do parts, or you pick a sample, or you take just the main figures.
Doing parts, sorry.
Yeah, doing parts, doing some, doing a little bit. Maybe take the one main result. But I can see what you're saying, especially, I don't know if you've, you know, worked on the university cluster service and all that, which can be sometimes difficult with the limits they have, time limits and stuff like that. So I can see what you mean, but I think it's still worth it. And if it's a, it's a, if it's a simple figure that you have, you've run a huge simulation for 3 weeks or something, then you've taken that data and created a figure, you can just do this part. Do these data, create this figure, because often they don't exactly do that. Cross-check your code and make sure that, you know, the different people in your lab that work together, the postdoc and the PhD student, can understand what the other person did. So when the postdoc leaves, you know, they leave behind a code that can do it. So these are ideas of what people could do. And if you're interested in the kind of details of teaching students through replication, I wrote a paper about this, which has basically all the things I said in a bit more detail. Right, and that's it. Thank you very much.
Sorry, I was just going to say, could I make a comment? I mean, that was fascinating, and I agree with everything you said, but as somebody who worked in industry, for most of my working life, it's a rather different situation, because you're not really wanting to publish things that your competitors will then find out about. So if you're a statistician and you want to publish piece of work in an applied statistics journal that requires data, and you've got data, that you're not going to be allowed to tell everybody what it all means. So you may be, and it probably would be all right to actually produce the numbers that, you know, as you mentioned earlier on, you're going to have sort of column A and column B rather than what these things actually are. Mm-hmm. So if you had journals with the very rigid requirement that you were suggesting on the right hand side, that would sort of effectively rule everything out, really. I wonder if you've got any comments.
So, we have, interestingly, a parallel conversation in political science where we have a lot of qualitative data, which is interviews, field notes, participant observation. Qualitative data where you don't want to reveal who the people are and where it's just, you can't scan 1,000 notebooks and then blank out, you know. So does that mean that those researchers cannot get into the top journal because the journal says we have a strict policy? Now, the answer that works for me is that there's a difference between data transparency and analytical or procedural transparency. And data transparency means you have to publish all the data or you don't get into the journal. Analytical transparency means that you show, you can't, for some reason, for copyright reasons, privacy reasons, you cannot publish the full data set, but you can say exactly how you have collected this data or how someone else could collect similar data if they want to follow what you did, but you publish your analysis code, like your R code. So this is something that people can do, like being very open with the description of your methods, and if someone else wanted access to that particular data set that you can share, how they could gain access or how they could get a similar data set. So it's kind of second best, but you would be very transparent in how you collected this data. And the journals that, so the top journal in my field, American Political Science Review, they say exactly that. They say, if you withhold your data for a particular view, write a page why you do it, and how people could get to this data or similar data instead. So there are loopholes. It's just that the editors are trying to prevent people from using those loopholes because they were too lazy to kind of prepare the data. But you're right, so there are a lot of researchers that are concerned that nowadays they may not be able to get published. And so I think it's important when you promote reproducibility to always talk also. I have a whole other talk about data transparency when you work with sensitive data. So that people yeah. know what can be done and what can't be done, and how you can still publish with certain kind of adjustments. Yeah.
Yeah, there's some discussion going on at the moment in the Radical Statistics email, which is about the use of postcode identified people. And this relationship to, I forget what the exact terminology is, but they call them output areas, and there's different classifications for this. But there is a big issue being discussed about the identifiability of people who have responded to surveys and things like that, where their individual postcode is available on the data. And then the discussion is about the extent to which it is possible to identify individuals, or conversely the extent to which it is necessary to suppress identifiability.
So this is so in the UK there's the UK Data Service. I don't know if you've heard of it, and they help a lot of social scientists, I don't know about other fields, anonymize their data. And they have an online repository there where they block the data set. First, so there are different ways you can do it. You can anonymize your data, and I think it's good to have proper training on how to do that, and the UK Data Service does that, that type of training. You can actually invite them into your lab and they will come and do that. But they can also block your data online, and only someone who requests access for particular parts for that data and someone with, you know, someone credible can then access the data after going through a few steps. So there are a lot of safeguards that can be used in that case. And that's really important, also legally, not just ethically, but also legally in the UK. You cannot just publish personal data that, and together with sensitive data. You can't do that.
I think the Data Protection Act is just changing too,
Soon,
I think.
Yeah, so I need to learn more about that, but I heard it's changing, and there maybe have to be adjustments on what you do.
Nicole, could you go back one slide so I can get the details of your paper? Thanks.
Because actually it might be questioned the very fact why do you need this data protection. In the same sort of statistical discussion I went for a group maybe a year ago, I forgot exactly the name of this group, the UK Biobank or something like this, they found, I don't know, many thousands of people in the States who were happy to share their data, who were signing all this, I don't know, consents, informed consents and whatever was necessary, just to support the research that was in the States, right? And then these people openly said, use my data. When this study tried to get their data from the NHS, they couldn't get it. There were lots of bias and they couldn't know it. I think that at some point, attempt to there is at least I feel this, maybe I'm from the culture, but there is a sort of hype around.
Yeah.
And this hype sometimes is not justifiable in my opinion. The only reasonable argument is about some insurance companies that could somehow change your So if it's getting stricter, I'm not sure it's getting to the right direction. And some people shy to whisper. Because they look like they're trying to invade some of
There's a surprising pushback against this sort of reproducibility work too. I can't remember exactly where it was, I think BMJ, a couple of authors who wrote a really unpleasant article
Oh, the parasite one?
Yes, the parasites, mm-hmm. Thank you. Horrendous. You should shove this in your jaw.
Actually,
so brutal.
Actually, there is an element of course with the truth. Because honestly, I remember it from my PhD when I was studying some biomarkers, I don't know, for response to treatment in some breast cancers. And I, from the very beginning, I knew that there were a dozen papers. Half of them were in favor of this biomarker, half of them were not in favor. And eventually, only interaction between this data, only this analysis and other stuff, allowed to find the consensus. And obviously, none of those papers, if you apply all these strict rules, would, none of them would be released.
No, but this, the purpose of this paper was the authors are making a very unpleasant statement about the fact that anyone who uses somebody else's primary data cannot do a sensible job of it because they understand nothing about what the data were about.
Yeah.
You can imagine how unpleasant this is.
I don't know this
paper. Oh, this,
I mean,
you've got to look at it. It's hilarious.
Just Google research parasites or something.
Yeah. It's, so we had the bioinformatics world, of course, had, we had science with parasites all down our corridors.
Okay, so I'm sorry, probably, you know, I'm not against it. But in general, this push for reproducibility might be detrimental. Because the thing, I remember I was in the lecture of the person called Dennis Slum. It's an author who developed one of the iconic treatments nowadays for breast cancer. And he said, it's called this trastuzumab. And he said that how he did it initially. He had 100 of samples of tumor in his somewhere hidden. He did the measure something by a method that currently would be considered substandard. He saw something that in some group of tumors, apparently this gene behaved differently than others. And he published it. Then he said that after a certain point, the academic world took on this news. And for some years, he started doubting his own results. So diverse was it, because how he measured it. So, and this is a real life in science. So if you try to apply the strict rules at each step, at some point that definitely misses it. Especially if you say that we have not trust us. But it should be very flexible for not to inhibit.
And then the whole business of fraud is just a very difficult one. So most of the discussion I've been in about reproducibility ignore fraud issue in the sense that extraordinarily difficult to detect unless you have a pointer about what was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you have whistleblowers in the lab or something like that. The difficulty, so it's a very complex discussion, right? And I know that a lot of researchers feel they are doing good work and they are feeling almost hunted, but hunted down by replicators. And so I always...
So
I promote people doing replications, especially students, it's great for them to learn. And I think it's good to double check work, but I think this is why I had all these slides, the funny slides about, you know, the tone you take. And when you say, oh, failed replication, I would be really careful going to the media saying, oh, I found, you know, fraud. I think you'd have to really double, triple check and first have a proper university internal investigation or things like that before you make such a claim. This would protect me as a replicator, but also, obviously, you don't want to destroy a whole career or a whole field. And then if you take it further, you know, someone like, I don't know, Donald Trump can very easily use all these scandals to discredit what the elite researchers are doing, or the climate change researchers, all the stuff they are doing. So there's a lot of, you know, there's complexity in the debate, and the way you phrase things is very important.
My other observation from industry is that there's huge variation, even in very simple analyses, between laboratories. A lot of collaborative work is done where a single sample is sent out to a whole load of different labs to assess something very similar. Within a lab, there's usually very good agreement between labs. It's amazing how different things can be. And this must have a knock-on effect if you're actually trying to reproduce an original piece of work.
That's why you need to write so carefully about how exactly you try to reproduce the experiment, because if you just change a tiny setting, or in your lab the environment is, I don't know, I don't know much, but maybe has slightly different temperature. If you don't write that in your replication study, you kind of, you're doing yourself a disservice as well.
But these are situations where the laboratories think they have everything controlled, and that they are all doing exactly the same thing, and yet, and they have no explanation.
Wet lab experiments, ozone concentrations, all sorts of stupid things,
In that sense, probably the transparency is an important thing, but the reproducibility should be very careful, because the more complex data we have, sometimes the reproducibility, even in conceptual point, doesn't make sense.
Could be true, yeah. For example, in qualitative research, if you go to some country, I don't know, Brazil, and you talk to poor people and microfinancing of women's projects or something, there's no way someone can replicate my kind of study in this exactly same way. And plus also, I'm a young, blonde researcher. If I go to interviews, and then a completely different person, maybe male and older or whatever, would go and try and do exactly the same, ask the same people exactly the same questions, they would get very different results. So I totally see the point here.
And this is, should you just keep in mind?
For sure. Yeah.
And definitely replication is not the situation of vindication.
Say again?
Replication is not vindication, if I'm pronouncing it.
Vindication, yeah, yeah.
Is this actual vindication?
Yeah. That's true as well, yeah.
That's sort of psychological. If you try to balance it, this may be the thing.
Too long analysis.
Related to this discussion is the, I'm not quite sure how to best describe it, but let me describe it as the dreaded exploitation of p-values. It takes me back to a remark in the book by actually a celebrated theoretical physicist, published sometime in the 1960s, I think. If you obtain a result which is significant to 5%, then 19 out of 20 of your colleagues are entitled to disbelieve you. And you have the situation where if you're going for a 5% significance level threshold, if nothing is happening in what you're looking at, then once in 20 you will get this result. And then in conjunction with that, you have the situation where journals tend to only publish papers which have significant results, and they do not publish papers which have non-significant results, even though these other papers constitute evidence about the truth.
Yeah.
So
it doesn't mean even that people don't actually write the paper.
Yes. Indeed, that's true. Yes.
It's the file drawer problem. All the studies that are in the file drawers because something came out insignificant, and then you do a meta-analysis only of the published studies, and you can't include those non-significant because they were never published.
Yes.
But that used to be the case, but depends on what is happening with the video patient data, where you actually perform studies which do not exist and reanalyze them.
So if you have that network and you have that knowledge, that's for testing.
This goes back to the situation where data should be stored and made accessible, even if it was never the subject of a publication, because it is relevant.
That's what the drug companies do.
Sorry?
That's what a lot of the drug companies are doing.
Is that right? They're making it available.
From old studies they've done that were never turned into a product.
And they're actually making it available?
Only within the companies. just stated. I mean,
right, so...
competitive advantage, right?
So it doesn't actually contribute to general scientific knowledge.
No. it does for them.
That's not general.
Well, it could be. It could be a very important life-saving drug.
Yeah. So, one of the journals of political science tried to get, let's say, all those non-significant studies out of the file drawer by, they had a special issue where they invited people to send in pre-registrations or like a pre-analysis plan, but without any data, so they stripped up all the data and results. And this was sent out to the peer reviewers, and if the question was important, the hypothesis was good, the method that was planned seemed great, and the peer reviewers said, yes, fine, that goes through. Only then would they put in the results, so kind of blinded results. And they were hoping that, essentially everyone was expecting that they would get a lot of insignificant findings in that special issue. It kind of turned out that not too many authors sent in anything for the special issue, so it didn't really take off that well, but I thought the idea was really good, to send in an article. Because, for example, I had a paper, my first paper out of the PhD was rejected by one of the peer reviewers who said, you have a bunch of insignificant findings, what are we learning from that? And so, well, I was really disappointed. I went to a different journal, and then, it got published in the end elsewhere, but that is something that journals maybe could do, and what does it matter if the result is significant or not? Doesn't it matter much more? This is a really good project, it was done in a really proper way, and these are the results. And no sexy detection of something, and no, surprises, but that would be an ideal world scenario.
Just a brief word about the multiple imputation you mentioned. Mm. I mean, if you were sending the data to people, would you actually send them all the imputed data sets? Or could you argue, because they're all, millions you could generate from the original, you could just send the original to them?
Depends.
Does it matter? I mean,
I guess so. I mean, I think it does. So, in my field, you would probably do maybe 5 imputations. So that is kind of easier, right? So what I would do is I would send the original data set, obviously, with all the missingness in it.
Mm.
Then I would send my code, we have certain packages, I do it in R, there's a package called Amelia. The package and exactly the code, how I specified everything for the multiple imputation, so that person could impute the data again. Now, I do know, though, that this can take a long time. I once did it 5 times on different computers, each took 2 weeks. Super annoying.
Also, at least in R, and probably in other software as well, if you are imputing by a method which uses random numbers, you can set the random number seed
right
at the beginning, and then it's strictly speaking reproducible.
Set seed.
Yes.
It needs to be in the code. Yeah, for sure. And so then I would personally also give the author, the replicator, say, those 5 imputed data sets for convenience. But if they really wanted to replicate what I did, they would have to set the same seed. But then who has... It sounds stupid, but, not everyone has 5 computers they can use. And the cluster service, I've tried to use it, but they always cut me off after so and so many days. And then... but there's one paper in my field, Globalization and Human Rights, that did a multiple imputation. I thought, fantastic, finally. And they used the software that I would use. And I said, okay, I'm learning how to do multiple imputation for my own work. How did you specify it? And in R, you can either use R or you can use something called R Commander or R Studio, or Amelia. The R package actually has a graphical user interface where you just click. And they said they had used the graphical user interface and never actually saved either the seed, the starting point, or the exact specifications of, And so they said, we can't actually tell you how we imputed the data. So, and it's a everyone, whenever I publish on that topic, everyone will kind of, all the peer reviewers, they notice this paper and they say, but they have proven this and this. And I've never taken it further because, okay, what can I do? But I'm thinking, yeah, but also I know I couldn't actually check what they've done. They don't even know anymore.
It's a bit sort of like a spreadsheet mentality creeping in.
Yeah. Yeah, well, at least they should have taken a screenshot of when you click, you know, have your little boxes. Yeah, setting seed, actually, for years I've been telling my students, set the seed and save it as a comment. Mm-hmm.
I think you can choose the seed as a random number, aren't you? Or would you just put it equal to one? Or
I just picked a number.
Right, okay.
Yes. You can pick the seed at random, but there is another R command which allows you to access what that is and store it before you...
Okay, so that's even better, yeah. Yeah, so it would save that number as an object or something.
Yeah.
I just randomly, 1001, 1002, 1003, I just did that.
Mm. Yeah.
May not have been a good idea.
I mean, it's probably more a theoretical part, because you wouldn't expect it to change by much, even if you didn't give them an imputed date. You know, they could do it themselves. Slightly different answer, but it should be very similar.
Yeah.
But I suppose the principle, when we say replication or duplication, you're thinking about the exact same data, aren't you?
True.
It isn't,
yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the whole idea about multiple imputation is that the difference between all those 5 or 10 imputed data set kind of, is reflected in the analysis and the uncertainty around your estimators.
Yeah.
And so ideally, a similar kind of uncertainty should be found if someone else reproduces with completely different starting points. Would ideally have a similar amount of uncertainty that then is reflected in their estimators.
Only if the data is missing a trunk. Someone else could do the same experiment to observe all the data.
Okay. So sadly and luckily in what I work with, this is often the case. Like if you think about variables like population size, wealth of a country, conflict in a certain year, human rights violations, you can often predict why a data point is missing, because there was a conflict in that year, or it's a really poor country, so they don't have statistics published on population side because they didn't do a census in that year. So luckily, in the multiple imputation makes a lot of sense with my data, because you can explain the missingness through your data set and you can nicely impute. The sad thing about that is that hardly anyone does multiple imputation, which means that all the list-wise deletion studies are heavily biased because the data are missing systematically, which is explained through the data in your variables. So it's convenient if you want to do multiple imputation in this field. It's convenient that you can explain it. But I mean, I don't know about your field, so. I have no idea where we are on time, by the way. I just, I'll keep talking until everyone has left the room.
That's right. Well, heard it here first.
And also, I mean, people keep making comments and asking questions.
I mean, we could always reproduce this, because obviously the weather's affected it a bit, so
yeah.
I mean, it would be in the spirit of the talk, of course.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Are you reproducible?
I have 2 children. They look like my husband, though. Very pretty children.
Well, perhaps on that note, thank you very much indeed. Fascinating.